Greetings and welcome to the Joshua Jenkins program. I want to talk to you a little bit in this episode about the Lord's Supper. At my church that I've been attending, my church that I've been at for the last 5+ years now, first couple of years spent as just a member and was going through pastoral training, and now next month it'll be 3 years now that I've been there at my church as an elder. And so I've been there for a little over 5 years now. And the whole time during that, our church has practiced taking the Lord's Supper on a weekly basis. I highly, highly recommend it. We take it every week. And so for the past 5 years or so, I've taken the Lord's Supper every week at my church, and it has changed my life. Because in the Lord's Supper, and taking it week by week with God's people, Christ has met with me there in his supper to remind me that my sins are forgiven and that this is his body, which is for me. Of course, we don't believe in transubstantiation, that the elements are transformed into literal body and blood of Christ, nothing like that, but he's truly there in a spiritual way. And so it's a precious time of sweet communion with our risen Lord. It's a actual means of grace, more than a memorial, but it's an actual means of grace, not transforming the elements, but Christ is still truly there. You know, in a word, we could say the Lord's Supper is important. It's important. In fact, just recently, me and my co-pastor have talked through the Lord's Supper. We took several weeks to teach through the Lord's Supper, particularly in the light of the fact that this past Sunday being our first Sunday, we have switched from using grape juice to actual wine in the Lord's Supper. The reason we did that, one of many reasons that we articulated, simply because the fact that we believe the Lord's Supper is important. It matters. And the elements of the Lord's Supper matter. It's one of the things I taught on. Unfortunately, the Lord's Supper is often met with flippancy in mainstream evangelicalism today, not just by the congregants in the pew, but by the ministers themselves. It's not important, you know, they'll use donuts and milk or Doritos and Mountain Dew or, you know, whatever it is. And that's, of course, just a joke. It's a joke. The Lord's Supper is bread and wine, body and blood of our Lord. And to use something of such a trivial nature as donuts and milk, I mean, it shows you don't understand the importance of the Lord's Supper. But you know, during the Reformation, the Lord's Supper was one of the most heated debates that went on. You know, of course, during the Reformation was not one unified movement. There was lots of various reformations going on, and various reformers in various regions throughout that time. And there was lots of different views of the Lord's Supper going on that were all reforming in different ways away from the Roman Catholic articulation, the Eucharist, and the bread and wine. And I won't get into all that. You can easily find that information in any good church history book or wherever, and you may be familiar with that already. But the point is that I want to talk about here with you in this episode, the point is that during the Reformation, and all the reforming that was going on, and all the doctrines being debated and practices being reformed, one of the most heated ones was over the Lord's Supper. Why? Because it was important. It was important. Even some of the good Protestants that today we would all love, you know, we love Luther and Calvin. Don't know much, unfortunately, don't know much about Zwingli or Beza or whatever, but we love Luther and Calvin, and yet Luther was, you know, he drew lines. He cut off fellowship with Zwingli over their views of the Lord's Supper. And so it was very important to them. It was very important. And we ought to take note of that and ask the question, why should we also begin to view it as important again? One of my favorite Reformation stories, at least centering around the Lord's Supper, is about John Calvin in the Lord's Supper. And I would very much agree with Calvin's views on the Lord's Supper, which I won't get into at this point in time. But Calvin, of course, he was there in Geneva, and there was a guy named Philibert Berthelier who had been excommunicated from the church, and as far as I can tell, rightly so. He was a libertine, which means he lived a licentious lifestyle. He had mistresses, and I think he physically assaulted somebody, beat them up. And so he was in a lot of, I think if those things are true, rightly excommunicated. But this guy, Berthelier, he decided to appeal to the civil magistrates to try and, ask them to force the church to allow him to still partake of the Lord's Supper. Of course, the civil magistrates have no business telling the church who can and cannot take the Lord's Supper. It's not their God-given jurisdiction. And of course, Calvin, this was in Calvin's Geneva, and he was, furious about this. And he appeared before, Calvin appeared before the council, and he declared before them that he would rather die 100 deaths than subject Christ to the disgrace of unworthy participation in the Lord's Supper. So just in that declaration of Calvin, we see his views coming out, that the Lord's Supper is more than a memorial. He did not believe in transubstantiation, that it's transformed into the body and blood of Christ. We don't believe that. But that Christ was truly there, a real presence spiritually in the Lord's Supper. And, therefore, if that's the case, then allowing a unworthy partaker, a man in unrepentant sin, to come and partake of the Lord's Supper was to, in Calvin's view, subject Christ to the disgrace of unworthy participation. The council, after listening to Calvin here, they ended up telling Berthelier that he could not take the Lord's Supper at the next upcoming communion service. They had it, I believe it was quarterly in Calvin's Geneva. But the council told Berthelier, hold off, don't take it at the next communion service, but we'll review it, in the future. And so Calvin, of course, viewed this as a compromise on the part of the council. And he was infuriated over this, and so he gets up into his pulpit and he denounces the decision of the council there to table that. He denounces it from the pulpit. And he declared at that communion service, if Berthelier were to show up, that he, Calvin, would defend the table of the Lord with his life. Basically, he was saying there, over my dead body will Berthelier take the Lord's Supper here. Well, Berthelier did not show up. He did not appear to the service. But how many ministers would defend the Lord's table with their life today? I'm afraid the answer is not many. Lots of reasons we could say for that. One, because it's just not that important to them. Two, they don't understand, maybe not understand, some don't understand, some don't have a right view that Christ is there truly, and it's truly a communion with Christ. And so it matters. Now, it's interesting that as our church has just taught on this and made our transition to using actual wine, this issue of the Lord's Supper, not an issue of wine or bread, but the issue of the Lord's Supper is kind of blown up a little bit in the Twitter sphere in terms of, I guess, Eastern Orthodoxy or various strains of Orthodoxy. And, you know, Protestants, there is various people saying things along the lines of, you know, the Lord's Supper being the center of worship and stuff for the early church, and video of Francis Chan going around where he said, you know, made these broad statements of the first 1500 years of the church, the Lord's Supper, the body and blood of Christ, was the center of Christian worship. And recently on The Dividing Line, James White dealt with that Francis Chan video, and I thought it was very well done. And so I'm not going to add or repeat any of that material, but you can go and listen to that episode for yourself to see the rebuttals that I would agree with. But, you know, it, on the one hand, I like seeing that this debate is now coming up again, that people are getting heated over this debate, because people realize and recognize a couple things: that the Lord's Supper is important, and two, that the worship of God is important. And so there's the debate over the things that matter, and I appreciate that. So it gives people an opportunity to articulate their theological convictions, and hopefully we can do so in a instructive and productive way. I, of course, have my disagreements with Eastern Orthodox view on many things. Appreciate some of them as well. But, you know, I think in general, thinking about using the Lord's Supper as a stepping stone here, to just generally talking about some of the Eastern Orthodox teachings and Protestants. You know, you see sometimes Eastern Orthodox or various Orthodox groups make statements like, well, the church didn't do X, Y, or Z, or they did X, Y, or Z for the first 1500 years, or for the, you know, for 1,000 years, or however long that particular thing. And so therefore, upon that basis, you know, modern church is wrong, or Protestants are wrong on X, Y, or Z. And while I find, of course, as James White deals with on The Dividing Line, no, the church was not unified in the way that it's painted for 1500 years, you know. But, you know, something that Protestants need to remember when they hear those kinds of things, definitional of being a Protestant, a reformational-minded Christian, a reformational Protestant, definition to that is the idea that we have no problem with development in terms of doctrinal development or development in church practice. And what I mean by that is not actual change in doctrine, but development in terms of the church's articulation of that doctrine and the church's understanding of that doctrine. You know, before Nicaea, early Christians, I'm sure, would not have had the same articulation and grasp on the Trinity as those who would come after, and those today who remain Orthodox in terms of the Trinity. And countless other examples we could go to. It takes time and years and controversy and persecution and times for debate and thinking and reformation for the church to develop its understanding and articulation of certain things. And that's why it's important to know church history, where we come from, when these debates first happened, and things of that nature. So Protestants, by definition, have no problem with development. And of course, when our doctrinal understanding and articulation develops, it changes then. That's what it means to be reformational. It changes the way that we practice our ecclesiology. And so Protestants need not to be afraid of such an argument. And of course, all underlying what I'm saying as a reformational Protestant myself, when we talk about these doctrinal developments in articulation and practice and understanding, it is not just progressive in a liberal sense, but development in the sense of going back to the sources, you know, going to the scripture, how we develop our understanding, articulation of what the scriptures are teaching, you know, sola scriptura. Of course, that's another great debate between Protestants and both Orthodox, all the Orthodox strands, and Roman Catholic. You know, they have various degrees of their belief in church history as authoritative, or tradition as authoritative. And you know, last thing I'll say before I just continue to ramble too much here. James White brought this up in his latest Dividing Line episode on this subject. And he mentioned that, you know, the reformers during the Reformation, they weren't, you know, blazing a new trail in that sense. They were going back to the church fathers. You know, they were going back to Augustine and those guys. And that's what they viewed it as. They weren't, you know, breaking from the good things in church history. They were breaking from the abuses and how different things have been elevated in inappropriate ways and doctrines twisted and so on and so forth. So anyway, before I ramble too much, I'll just cut it off there. I hope some of this has been beneficial to you. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.